Live from Petonia, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to the latest episode of Cinematica, your favourite roundup of cinema news and reviews, helping you to choose what to see next when the rain means you're choosing to go to the movies instead of sitting out in your back garden. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio is...
Kaylee Carruthers.
G'day, Kaylee. How are you?
Good. I'm good. I'm just madly downloading the top movies for the week.
Oh, excellent. Yes, very important, because we'll be getting onto that very shortly. Every week we're here to review all of the latest releases, talk to interesting people about what they've been watching, and we keep a close eye on what's happening around the world too, films and stories that we're looking forward to. In today's episode, we're joined once again by our favourite movie academic, Miriam Ross, to help us talk about Scorsese's Hugo and the latest developments in 3D and some history as well. We'll sum up the Cold War thriller Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I get a tour of Moscow while being chased by aliens that set off light bulbs in the darkest hour. And Kaylee learns how to whisper to horses with the new documentary Buck. All of that and more in this week's edition of Cinematica. Now, this is episode 14, and I've been saying live for 14 episodes now, and I have to say that we're not actually live, we're actually recorded, and I just feel like a little bit of a fraud. One day we will be live, and you will get a chance to hear this this podcast as it is recorded by us around this octagonal table here in Petone. But for the time being, just bear with us, and live in inverted commas, in air quotes.
Yes, but won't it be exciting when it is live? You can hear us making all those awful gags and sneezing and coughing.
And the tummy rumbles,
and
all
the tummy
of that.
Rumbles, yes.
So I've managed to get that off my chest. My conscience is now clear. What else have we got in terms of feedback and follow-up? Kaylee, what's in the mailbag?
Well, actually, we have some exciting news this week, because we have some passes to give away.
Oh, yes, they're in my bag here.
Oh, my goodness. Because you can all see it, and he pulls them dramatically out of his bag.
Well, no, I'm very excited because I remembered to bring them. So we've got a fistful, I think that's probably the most accurate assessment of how many there are, of double passes to actually their single passes. So we'll give them out as doubles. Mm. To a film called Weekend, which is going to be in cinemas from February the 9th. And... we'll be telling you all about it a little bit later on.
Yes,
so we'll be rewarding some of our best and favourite two-word reviews.
Yes, and some of our best and favourite two-word reviewers on Twitter have come back this week with some fantastic reviews. So Barnaby HM said Melancholia was embracing fire, which I thought was a very beautiful two-word review this week.
Vivid.
Andrew JC009, two-word review for Hugo is cinephile porn because it was so good. And that review is wonderful.
Yeah, that might put a few people taking their kids off, though. We have to point out that that's metaphorical.
Yes. The Myrka, M-Y-R-K-A, if you can tell me how you pronounce that, and then I'll get you on the show more often, I guess. Hugo equals spectacular invention. Well done.
Fantastic.
Puntastic, yes.
Well done.
And TinRibs27, who is, of course, one of our favorite tweeters, and he sends us our reviews as well, which we pass on to you. Two-word review for Warhorse is Borehorse. Which I found really funny.
And I'm sure that's keeping Steven Spielberg up at night as we speak. So, enough about what people have been watching, what our listeners have been watching over the last week or so. What have the rest of New Zealand been watching? What's the top five, Kaylee?
The top five this week, we have a lot of...
If the chipmunks are still there, I might just have to retire.
The chipmunks are at number six.
Yes, they're out of the top five.
Phew. Out of the top five.
I don't have to eat anything.
But coming in at number five, which we'll be reviewing shortly, is Hugo. Number four, The Darkest Hour, we will also be reviewing. Number three, War Horse. Number two, still sticking in at number two, is The Adventures of Tintin. And number one is Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows.
And Fair Enough, too.
Yes, still at number one.
Yeah. You know, in this line of work, I get asked a lot by people, what should I go and see? What should I go and see? One of the reasons why we started the podcast, to try and help people make those decisions. But I must admit, over Christmas, it was a really difficult one to answer. So generally, it would be like, well, if you're one kind of person, then go and see Tintin. And if you're another kind of person, then go and see Melancholia. And there really wasn't sort of much going on in the middle. But so at last, Sherlock Holmes came out last week, and I can that'll cover most eventualities, I think. I don't think there'll be too many people that would be disappointed by Robert Downey Jr. in Sherlock Holmes. We liked it, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And also, as you're saying, as we get into the end of January, things will be a lot more broad spectrum for lots of different movies for lots of
indeed, and all and so much award fodder. Coming up in the next sort of 3 or 4 weeks. I think probably 6 Academy Award contenders coming out in the next 3 weeks. Yes. It's just going to be absolutely full on. People might be wondering why we're not going to talk about the Golden Globes.
Oh, you shouldn't have said Golden Globes. You should have said the award ceremony that was on last night that we shall not name.
Yeah,
like Voldemort.
Right. Well, basically, we don't believe that the Golden Globes is sort of indicative of anything, really. It is, frankly, 87 self-appointed blowhards throwing a party for themselves.
And I think it's indicative of Ricky Gervais's career.
I was just going to say, it's actually 88 because I've forgotten about Gervais. But it's, you know, it's irrelevant. We're going to ignore it. We do talk about various awards that we think might lead to or give us some clues about the Academy Awards, but frankly, the Golden Globes is a diamond encrusted lottery.
It's a dress up party,
exactly, and that's
wonderful.
Fine, that's fine. But we're a serious cinema podcast, so we're not going to go there. But we are going to go to our first review.
There is a mole right at the top of British intelligence. He's been there for years. I know that it is one of these men. All I want from you is one code name. Tinker. Tailor. Soldier. Spy.
John le Carré's iconic Cold War spy novel, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I can't be independent about this. I can't be objective because I've been a John le Carré fan since I was a school kid. I've read everything multiple times, and I remember watching the original BBC television version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy when it first was broadcast, and I think I've watched it 2 or 3 times since then.
So, and just before watching it, I recall you, I think you watched it again.
I did
your research.
I did. I was prepared. And once again, I should stop doing it. I should just stop doing that sort of preparation because as a result, I don't let the film stand on its own 2 feet.
Mm.
And it stuffed me with Norwegian Wood last year, and it stuffed me again with Tinker Tailor. Having said that, I think I've read the book 3 times, I've watched the television series 3 times, and I was watching the TV series again before the film came out, and I was thinking, I still don't remember who did it. It's something about it's so convoluted, it's so complicated, and there are so many dark alleys and wrong turns. It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But I can't be independent and sit on the fence with this version of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So I might just hold back for a moment and then save my I guess, you know, there are lots of Tintinologists who got to express their opinions about Tintin, but it's not really fair. So I'll just hold back and let you start, Kaylee, and then I'll.
Well, in case you didn't know what Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was about, it's based on the classic novel of the same name. And the international thriller is set at the height of the Cold War years of the mid-20th century. George Smiley, who's played by Gary Oldman, is fantastic. As a disgraced British spy, is rehired in secret by his government, which fears that the British Secret Intelligence Service, also known as MI6, has been compromised by a double agent working for the Soviets. And the film is rated M and contains violence and offensive language, so you know your rating just before you go. I am not as well versed in Tinker Tailor as Dan is.
But I'm a tinkerologist.
That should be the name of the podcast. Dan Slevin, tinkerologist. I really enjoyed it. The group I went with, it was definitely mixed reviews. Some of us liked it, some of us didn't. Some of us read different things into it. And I enjoyed it, but I sat down in the theater and I really invested in it. And I find because it, as you said, it's so convoluted and it's such a like heavy story and you're trying to solve a mystery and really nothing is ever given away, which is fantastic. So many movies are so predictable and you know exactly what's coming, but this one really keeps you going. It is a bit long. But if you're willing to invest, if you're willing to sit down with your popcorn or your glass of wine and just enjoy yourself and really get into a mystery, this is it. And this is definitely a film for you.
It gives you credit, doesn't it? It gives you credit. It trusts that you will concentrate, that you will pay attention. If you're the kind of audience member who's used to getting everything on a plate and having everything explained to you, then you will find it frustrating because you will have to do some work. I've read some reviews online from people who felt that they, you know, said, oh, I didn't understand it. It was too complicated. And I would say, as a tinkerologist, that's actually fair enough because there are a couple of bits that have been compressed or condensed from the novel that don't help. It's almost like it's a scene short. Or two scenes short from really being able to totally grasp all of the implications behind it and also some of the connections between, you know, because we've got one of the best detectives, the greatest detectives in cinema history there, George Smiley, played by Gary Oldman. And and you think, oh, you've made a leap or two there. And in the book, it's explained exactly how he's reached some conclusions. But in the film, it does sort of crack on a wee bit. Mm. Brilliant cast. An absolutely staggering cast of venerable old and middle and young British actors. It's nice to see Toby Jones, who's a little actor who often is in comedic roles and is the butt of various jokes because he is very short. He played Truman Capote in one of those, the one that wasn't Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah,
and he is actually Truman Capote size, whereas Philip Seymour Hoffman is like twice.
It's an American size.
But that's a digression. Anyway, it's really nice to see him get something meaty to get into. He's a good dramatic actor, and I think that's the same is true of all of them. Benedict Cumberbatch, those cheekbones.
I love him. His Sherlock, I just am so in love with.
Yes, but that's television, which we don't talk about it,
but I love Benedict. I love him just as much as I love Colin
Firth.
And
you were even able to cope with his overacting in War Horse.
I didn't see War Horse.
Oh, you haven't seen War Horse yet? No. Oh, okay, well, trust me, he's just as much as guilty as all of them.
After I saw that he was in it, I was like, maybe I shouldn't see War Horse. It would just
ruin
him.
No, don't spoil it. But Colin Firth is in it. It's a fantastic cast. I should mention also Thomas Alfredson, the director of Tinker Tailor. He made Let the Right One In, which was the best vampire movie of the last 10 years, really. There's been a lot of attempts to sort of breathe life into that genre, but Let the Right One In did something quite spectacular. And he has got a fantastic eye. And a film that really could be a lot of middle-aged white guys sitting around tables talking to each other. And in fact, the book, it's a lot of that in the book, and the TV series is also a lot of that. To try and turn that into something visual that has a visual style of its own, I think he just does a fantastic job. I'm not entirely convinced that the British Secret Service in the early 1970s all had stylish open-plan offices. But, you know, whatever, he's done a terrific job. Something else that's not in the book and not in the TV series that he has introduced is the Christmas party, the office Christmas party for the British Secret Service, which does really, really well. And if you are a tinkerologist like myself, you'll be pleased to know that if you look closely at that Christmas party, John le Carré himself is sitting at one of those tables. So it has been given the seal of approval
by
the master. Mm. Yeah, indeed. So I think, you know, I have some potential issues, but I hope that people who don't know the books will use it as an excuse to go and read them, because I think that they're fantastic. But generally speaking, a thumbs up from me. And you, Kaylee?
Yes, so my two-word review has to be fantastic investment.
Yeah, well done. Nice work. Mine is something missing, because I think there is something missing, but I think, you know, it's pretty good, intelligent fodder. And, you know, there's precious few films that take you seriously these days, eh?
What's your name, boy?
Hugo. Hugo Cabré. Who built him?
I would think a magician. The most complicated one I've ever seen.
Can we fix him?
Of course we can fix him. This is a treacherous place, do you understand? Watch your step.
So we could get into trouble. That's how you know it's an adventure.
Hugo, Martin Scorsese's first children's film, family film. Although Kundun, that was sort of a family film, wasn't it? Not huge amounts of blood and violence and swearing in Kundun, as I recall. But it's his first film in 3D also. And joining us here in the Cinematica studio is Miriam Ross, who's our 3D expert and also our film history expert. So what better a topic to introduce you to the show once again? For people who are new to the podcast, Miriam was here for episode 2, during which I forgot to switch several microphones on, so that was very early in the podcast.
But her microphone is on tonight.
Yes, indeed. So, Miriam, tell us a little bit about your impressions of Hugo.
I thought it was a fantastic film, and I think it's one of those films which makes sense in 3D. So a lot of people have their doubts about 3D, but this is a magical film, and you can't envision seeing it 2D. You're going to miss so much of those little magical touches.
Indeed, it's adapted from a children's book, and it's about a young ragamuffin orphan who this is sort of post-World War One in one of the great railway stations of Paris, and his job is to wind the clocks that keep everything running in the railway station. But he is an orphan. His father has passed away, and he's sort of on the run as well. The station attendant, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, is desperately trying to sort of keep the station free of pilferers and louts and what have you. And Hugo has an automaton, which is how would you describe it? It's like a precursor to a robot. And he's using his watchmaking skills that he's taught by his father to try and repair the automaton, hoping that once he's got it repaired and got it working, it will contain a message from his father. And in order to get the parts, he has to steal from the toy shop down on the floor of the railway station, which is owned and run by a very sad, tired old man played by Ben Kingsley, Sir Ben Kingsley. And it's when those two meet that kickstarts the story, because nobody realizes quite what the connections between them will be. And it really does, something magical happens between them. You've also got a very young actor, Asa Butterfield, and a venerable old actor playing really well off each other. So that's the sort of the plot we're talking about. What about the 3D? Do you feel, Miriam, actually, like what is Scorsese doing with 3D that lesser talents aren't?
Well, on the one hand, he's got a really good team behind him, so it's really skillful 3D. There's very little the ghosting problems, very little flicker effect, so it's high-quality 3D, but he's also been willing to play around with it. So there's beautiful moments, for example, when the snowflakes come out of the screen into the auditorium. There's little tiny dust motes and particles and lots of scenes. So even though you maybe don't realise at the time, you're being drawn into a connection with the action.
It's texture, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And that's something that I felt watching Tintin as well, was that there was often quite a lot of dust as books were opened and what have you. And that just helps draw you into a scene. And I thought that it was something that Scorsese did fantastically well. Kaylee, what did you think?
I really loved it. I thought it was wonderful. I think I went with two other people, so it's nice to kind of be in a group, because you know, doing Cinematica, people don't always want to come to the movies with you.
why ever not?
We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
But I really enjoyed it, and it was interesting because the synopsis is really, the synopsis you get is really about the first half of the film.
Which is where I stopped, yeah.
Yes, because if you talked about the second half of the film, it would give too much away. Mm. And so I don't want to give it away, but it's wonderful and really it's interesting because you think the story is about this automaton, but that's really, and he needs the key to get it to start, but the automaton itself is actually a key to the rest of the story.
Exactly. And the second half of the film soars, doesn't it? It really, I don't want to talk too much about it, except that I guess it reflects a lot of Scorsese's own obsessions about movies and movie magic and archives and preservation. And so it's a wonderful film because it works. You can see how much it works on a personal level for Scorsese, but at the same time, he's applying that craft to something that's really quite universal.
Mm. And I don't think it's giving away too much to say that Ben Kingsley is playing Georges Méliès, the early filmmaker. And for any lovers of film history, it's based loosely on facts. So there is a real story to this.
Yeah, the bones there are really good, aren't they? And I must admit that I didn't know too much about it the first time that I went to see it and was carried along with it. It's even better second time around, though. It really is a film that I watched it again on Sunday night, and it was just a magical experience. And it's interesting because when the first trailers came out for the film middle of last year, and people were talking about Scorsese in 3D, and it looked really glossy and animated and digitally sort of had a digital sheen around it, and it really didn't look very promising. And yet, we should trust, shouldn't we? We should trust that Marty Scorsese actually does know what he's doing. And
yeah, and as one of the people in my group noted, is that this is actually a really important film for young audiences to watch, and those who aren't familiar with film history, that's actually a very important document that's been created, although maybe slightly glamorized, but it would be a very, very important film for young kids to see, because they don't understand how film used to be or that it was film at all.
Exactly. And I'll take that even further and say that it isn't just, if you go beyond just the film aspect of it, the metaphor that film is used for, the idea of everything having a purpose in life and nothing needing to be wasted, and that such an honorable occupation to fix things and make them work again. That's a really positive, we live in such a disposable age where when something breaks, we throw it away. And to be taught that there's something wonderful and magical about making something mechanical go again and giving it purpose and using that as a metaphor for human beings as well. We're going to talk a little bit later on today about Buck. And I think that it's a similar sort of message there about fixing things that are broken and not just writing them off. So I saw the screening on Sunday of Hugo. It was a public screening at Reading Cinemas in Wellington, and there was a spontaneous round of applause at the end as the credits rolled. And I haven't experienced a round of applause in a cinema apart from at festivals where, it's a different kind of audience. But, I think that says a great deal about how much of an impact Hugo is having on audiences. And, it's already in my top five for the year, and it's going to take something pretty flash to knock it out, I think. So anything anybody else wants to add about that performances, cinematography?
I think even just the fact that it's doing well at the box office, number five, considering it's not being promoted as heavily as other big 3D releases. So it didn't have a worldwide day and date release. It's really built upon word of mouth, and people are telling their friends, go see this, or their families, go watch this.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's entirely plausible that perhaps the studio didn't realise quite what they had, mm-hmm. and were content to sort of just let it do whatever it was going to do. This is a film that I think really does deserve big screen attention. I don't know whether it's, we talk about, how important it is to watch films on a big screen, but, not everything entirely needs that environment, but Hugo certainly does. I recommend it wholeheartedly. Have you got a two-word review?
Mine's more than two words, but I have to say one for the archives.
Okay, I'm just going to try and work out how I can turn that into two words. No, I can't. Okay.
Awesome archival darkness.
All right. It's a keeper.
It's a keeper.
Yeah, yes. Definitely. Mine is almost perfect. And I know this is a lot to ask you, Miriam. You've been overseas while we've been starting this whole two-word review meme. But do you have two words for us?
Magical Milieus.
Brilliant. Mm. You're good at this.
Yes. And Hugo is rated...
Oh, it's rated G with G. No notes.
Yes.
And so there were, which is fantastic. It's very, very rare. And there were a lot of rural youngsters at the screening that I was at on Sunday. And they didn't seem to be too bored or restless. Or there was a little bit of talking and muttering and a few sort of... But generally speaking, I thought they were really well behaved and really engaged. And for real young ones, maybe having to sit with glasses on for a long time might be a little bit of a hassle. There are 2D options around for the real young ones. But certainly sort of 6-7 years old and above, if they've got patience to sit with the glasses on, they'll get a big kick out of it. It really is two great young actors for them to sort of tie themselves to. Yeah, awesome. We're nearly halfway through the show, so it's time for some news.
Thank you, Dan. Overnight in the UK, the Film Policy Review Panel released its report on the state of the British film industry, and here's Dan with a summary of its recommendations.
Actually, this is really boring, but I would say there was a lot of fear about this film policy review because Cameron, the British Prime Minister, had been making all sorts of fairly ignorant statements about how if only the British film industry made films that people wanted to watch, then they would. I think I'm summarising it pretty accurately. It really was, his position was more films like The Full Monty and more films like...
More King's Speech.
More The King's Speech, mm. Exactly, and more films like Harry Potter and everything will be hunky-dory and then the industry won't need the sort of support from the government. And I mean, it's just nonsense. And I know that a huge number of people in the industry are just completely up in arms at his... and the Conservative government's take on this. The Film Policy Review Panel, their position, it turns out to be much more sort of acceptable and pretty hard to argue with any of it. One idea, for example, is to stage an annual British Film Week to encourage people to go back to the cinema to watch British films. And, you know, that's all very good. And actually here in New Zealand, Ant Timpson was suggesting a couple of years ago that we should have a New Zealand Film Month, and was trying to persuade cinemas to dedicate certain screens in their complexes to showing New Zealand films. Not a bad idea at all. Another one, bring film education into every school. You know, can't argue with that. So I just think that it's something to follow with interest, the state of the British film industry, because where they go, we tend to follow in terms of the New Zealand Film Commission and the funding and the politics around film funding. So anyway, that's about as up-to-date as I can get on that.
Yes, that's all the Academy Awards. We posted in the news feed on the website, the Academy Awards have also changed some of their regulations, which are pretty ridiculous, so it's just a worldwide phenomenon.
Mm.
Moving on. The Italian Costa Concordia ship that has today been in a terrible accident.
Actually, I pasted that in on Saturday, so I think it actually happened
Saturday.
On Saturday.
Oh, Daniel. The Italian Costa Concordia ship, which was in an accident recently, a terrible accident, was the same one that was in Godard's film Socialism.
Indeed, that was the location. Well, it's sort of trivia, but it's also an excuse for me to say, why can't I see film Socialism? It wasn't in the film festival, and no one's going to release it. And it's like, it's Godard, for Pete's sake. We should have a chance to see his work on the big screen. So, yeah, I'm annoyed by that.
All right.
And I'm very upset about the ship sinking as well, obviously.
Yes, obviously. That's terrible. But now on to some good news. The Wellington film fans can enjoy some outdoor screenings from Wednesday night in the Botanic Gardens as part of the annual Summer City Festival. Films include Exit Through the Gift Shop, Bill Cunningham, New York, and Florin Habit's... Tell me if I pronounce this right. Kaikohe?
Close enough.
Demolition and the 80s family classic Labyrinth. We will put the link to that information in the show notes. And our Auckland fans also have an outdoor screening series produced by Open Air Cinema,
which is huge. It's going on for a couple of months. So in Wellington, we're getting four. Auckland's got like 2 months worth, and it's a roadshow that's traveling all around the greater Auckland region, which is fantastic. Some excellent films in that lineup. So again, the link will be in the show notes.
Yes, and also in Auckland, the Silo series is running every Friday night until the 24th of February at the new Wynyard Quarter.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, that's the new development down by the tank farm, what used to be called the tank farm on the Auckland waterfront. So that sounds exciting. It is. And it's been proved to be a very popular location. There's restaurants and what have you down there as well. And so having done a little bit of research into what's going on around the country, it turns out that Wellington's actually not very well served. I mean, yes, fantastic. We've got four films in the Dell, which is a beautiful location, and fingers crossed the weather will hold. But certainly if you're in the Auckland region, there's a chance for some absolutely awesome outdoor movie experiences.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, I'll throw to you for the next piece of news, because I remember you were very excited and thought this was quite funny about John Carter.
Yes, well, Andrew Stanton, the director of John Carter from Mars, who is one of the great Pixar directors, was doing a sort of Twitter Q&A recently and answering lots of questions about the making of the film and his career, etc., etc. And at one point, he mentioned that he really wasn't into 3D, didn't think much of 3D. And in fact, he also shot John Carter from Mars on film because it was probably the last chance he was ever going to get. So he made a point of doing that. And somebody asked him, well, what do you mean you aren't into 3D? John Carter is in 3D. And his reply was, Disney put it in 3D, not me. It's their money. I made it 2D. And so the chances of Andrew Stanton, he made Finding Nemo, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
And which is coming out in 3D.
Which is coming out in 3D. I don't think he had nothing to do with that as well, I imagine. So the chances of him working for Disney again, slender.
Mm, and finally, one of the richest men in the world complains about candy bar prices.
More Twitter news.
More Twitter news. From Rupert Murdoch.
Can you do an Australian accent?
It'll be really offensive.
Okay,
and I know we'll get a lot of hate mail for it, so I'm just going to read it in my Canadian accent. Agree about cinema prices, which are out of our control, but even more offensive are the prices for popcorn and sodas.
Rupert Murdoch.
We'll put a link to that tweet, and you can reply to it.
One of the richest men in the world. I think the last time he bought popcorn, I don't know. Would have been decades ago, I would imagine. But anyway, he is. He's expressing some commitment to the common man.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's it. Have you got any more news?
I'm just so unimpressed that I just that's the end of the news.
Deeply unimpressive. and actually, I think the jury is still out whether that is even Rupert Murdoch tweeting. But we shall, no doubt, we shall find out before next week. That is the news, and it's back to reviews now.
A lot of times, rather than helping people with horse problems, I'm helping horses with people problems.
In this particular discipline, you have to be a sensitive person.
See there? She's trying to protect herself. There's a change.
That vulnerability is what makes you great.
That's why so many of the folks that are really good at this are, sometimes they're tortured souls.
My dad had a violent temper. He was a terrifying person. When something is scared for their life, I understand that. Nobody's here to hurt you.
Buck. Kaylee, you've seen Buck?
Tell us
about it.
I have. Well, it did play at the film festival this year, so if you missed it there, it is going to be in limited release, I think, starting Thursday.
Thursday, yep.
Yes, so this is another preview review for you this week, which is great. So Buck is rated PG, which contains violence and coarse language, and it follows the story of Buck Brannaman, who is a true American cowboy and sage on horseback, and he travels the country for 9 grueling months a year, helping horses with people problems. It's a richly textured and visually stunning film, which follows Brannaman from his abusive childhood to his phenomenally successful approach to horses. A real-life horse whisperer, he eschews the violence of his upbringing and teaches people to communicate with horses through leadership and sensitivity, not punishment. He possesses near magical abilities as he dramatically transforms horses and people with his understanding, compassion, and respect. And of course, Buck Brannaman, who is referred to as the real Horse Whisperer, is referred to as such because he worked on the Horse Whisperer with Robert Redford, and he was Robert Redford's stunt double and also was helped the horse trainer when because his horse could do tricks that the trained horses could not.
So. Yeah, and that got him to Hollywood and made a reputation there. But he has been traveling around America and the world because he's in New Zealand.
He
this
is
week.
In New yeah. Zealand right now. So if you're lucky enough to track him down, go to one of his shows. Even if you don't have a horse, you can just go and pay to watch him.
Because he is a philosopher, a sage, a wonderful. Wonderful human being. What can you say? Really, this for me is it's the this year's equivalent of Bill Cunningham, in that you know you for an hour and a half you're in the presence of somebody who just you want to learn from, whose attitude to life is just so immaculate and impeccable that you think that the you just want some of it to rub off on you. He is an extraordinary man. And watching him work with horses, and you can see that it's a philosophy that would go across his relationships with people as well. Just an amazing, amazing man. And he rations out those wonderful smiles, doesn't he? So,
yeah.
You know, he's a taciturn sort of like a Marlboro Man cowboy. And then every so often he'll say something that you think, was he joking? And then he'll just unleash this wonderful smile. It just lights up the screen. So, yeah, an extraordinary film. I wasn't really expecting very much because I'm not really into horses, and I'd seen the trailer and I was thinking, well, you know, am I looking forward to this? Not really. And yet he just wins you over as an extraordinary human being. And his background as a child, being trained to do rope tricks in sort of Texan show business, and really bullied quite badly by his father, and to take that lesson and to actually flip it and not repeat the same patterns, I think it's wonderful.
And it's incredible the way he can communicate with horses. It's like he definitely has a gift. And it's really inspirational, and it's so good. It's just like a warm hug. Like this documentary is like a warm, wonderful little cinematic hug.
Well, what he realizes and what he proves is that yes, he can communicate with horses, but that's because he listens as well. You know, communication is a two-way street. It isn't just about, you know, telling them what to do. You know, you've got to be sensitive, and he is incredibly sensitive to what's going on around him, and that's actually. I have to say that is very likely a result of his abusive childhood, is that in that situation, when you come from that situation, you learn to be acutely aware of what's going on around you in order to be able to react to it. So he just happens to have taken that skill and applied it in this really positive way. But a wonderful film, and I don't believe that anybody would watch it and be disappointed or not take something from it, eh?
So good. I just have this like dreamy look on my face. I'm like, oh, I just want to watch it again.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I didn't have many high hopes for it, and it turns out to be one of the
but you are wearing a denim shirt today, so you look like you're ready for the part to review
and
back.
And I must admit that one day I will get some cowboy boots, and because I love country music. People say to me, what kind of music do you like? And I say, I like both kinds, country and western. And so I will find myself on the Montana plains or what have you.
I can take you to my hometown, and we can go to the rodeo in Canada. We can go to the rodeo.
That's a date. That's a deal. Excellent.
We will do a live show from the rodeo in July.
What's your two words for Buck?
I can't do two words this week. I'm just too wordy. So I'm going to say ropes you in. That's one word.
Yeah, yin. Excellent. Well, mine, my two words, I have got two words here. Restorative Americana.
Oh.
So sometimes I can actually do this thing. Miriam, you've just been overseas, haven't you? You were doing some research into Archive 3D. Tell us a little bit about what you were looking at while you were away.
Yeah, I was in Berlin and Germany because they have some films from the 1930s, which are films that were made under the National Socialist regime. So it's a little bit terrifying. As it turns out, they're not propaganda films, but they are short films that were to be made with the permission of the government. And yeah, they're quite interesting and exciting.
In the 1930s, what sort of technology were they using for 3D? Because in those days, my understanding is that it would have had to have been the coloured glasses.
No, this is the Zeiss Icon system, which is one of the first developments of the polarising system. So, they shot it with two cameras and they screened it with polarised glasses.
And black and white?
Yep. So one of the things I actually saw was a trailer for the new system, and the trailer was in 2D, but it was all about telling people how excited they will be to put on these glasses and watch it in 3D.
So with this technology was invented in Germany?
It was developed there. I mean, there's a lot of claims about who invented what, because there's a lot of crosstalk, Europe, also in Russia and across in the States. So a lot of people were developing things at the same time. But yeah, this was a system that was pioneering at its time.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because We were talking about Hugo a little bit earlier on, and how I think one of the joys of it is that Scorsese is using the most modern technology to basically tell audiences that it's okay. You know, film has always gone looking for new toys, new tricks, for new ways of telling stories, and Méliès's films were the first sort of big budget special effects movies, and that this digital 3D that we have now is just another stage in the development of a visual medium. And to know that desire to watch films in stereoscopically in 3D was happening at around the same time as sound was being added to films, you know, that people weren't happy. They weren't satisfied, were they?
Well, one of the great things about these movies, I mean, they're very gimmicky in terms of the two short films throw things at the audience, but there's a real sense of play. There's a real sense of recognising the audience is there. And that's one of the great things that Hugo does, is it recognises there's an audience. So forget this idea of it being a beautiful story that's playing out somewhere and you just have to, you know, just happen to be looking onto it. These films are all about speaking directly to the audience member and saying, hey, we know you're there and we're going to play with you.
And there's a moment in Hugo where an audience watches the famous train going into a station for the first time, and of course the legend is that they freak out. They think they're going to get run over by a train. And I mean, can you imagine what would have happened? I mean, if the Lumiere brothers had invented 3D at the same time as they invented film, they may have stopped.
Well, the interesting historical thing is that the Lumiere brothers were experimenting with stereoscopic cinema right in the beginning, but it was in 1935 that one of the Lumiere brothers actually finally got this stereoscopic process to work and went back and filmed the arrival of the train again in 3D.
I didn't know that.
So what is a little bit complicated is a lot of people have seen it and they actually think that the 1935 version was from 1903 for some reason. So there's some bad history out there that tells everyone the arrival of the train was in 3D in 1903. Apparently it's not, it's 1935, but it's still very exciting early developments.
That's fantastic. I didn't know that. That's awesome information. Thank you for that. And I'm sort of a little bit stunned to know that. I was purely speculating. Miriam, we'll have you back on the show to talk more about 3D in future, because it's a topic that certainly isn't going to go away. I'd love to talk to you more about the industry side and the way the business side of 3D works, because at some point, I would imagine the surcharges are going to have to go away and the glasses. In the US, they were giving away the glasses for free until very recently to try and get people to buy into going to 3D. Whereas here in New Zealand, we've been paying extra for the 3D screenings and for the glasses. So,
but of course, there is the new thing that they're trying to start is designer 3D glasses, where you get reusable designer ones. And I've tried them on, mm-hmm. and I've tried them out, and I do like them.
They're very stylish, aren't they?
They are very stylish. I feel so cool.
I love my clip-ons. Yes. I have to say.
I love my aviators, my golden aviators.
All right, our final review for the show is up next.
This wasn't just Moscow. New York, London, Paris, Tokyo, all reported invisible invaders.
They came here with a plan. They can see us, but we can't see them.
What do they want?
energy, electricity.
Oh my god.
What a load of tosh that was. The Darkest Hour, which I think is actually called The Darkest Hour 3D because that's pretty much its only selling point.
Well, there's The Darkest Hour and The Darkest Hour 3D because it's released in both.
Oh, okay. So. All right.
But well, indeed, it was the darkest hour and a half of my life this week.
It's about four attractive young people who are...
There's a fifth.
Which one's the fifth
there's
one?
There's that angry Swedish
oh,
guy.
Oh, the angry Swede. Oh,
or the,
well,
sorry,
he's not he wasn't
angry
attractive.
Russian.
He wasn't attractive, the angry Swede. He was just a coward. And anyway, so what have we got? Let's plot-wise. Two American software designers have invented a new social network, and they're trying to raise money for it. So they go to Moscow to try and sell the technology. Turns out that their business partner, this annoying... douchebag Swede has
he's Russian.
No, he's a Swede.
He's a Swede,
definitely, because he was heading to the Swedish embassy. To,
oh, right.
Yeah. No, because the Russians are good guys in this, just about. And the anyway, so he's gone behind their back and sold the technology, so they end up going to a bar to drown their sorrows. And what interesting casting is that Max Minghella, who is one of the software designers, basically the same thing happened to him in The Social Network. So he's playing the same character.
Aww.
He was one of the guys that got ripped off in The Social Network. Anyway, so they have they try and drown their sorrows at a Moscow nightclub, meet a couple of attractive young women, one of whom's an Australian photographer who doesn't appear to carry a camera, and her personal assistant, and then their night is wrecked, you could say, because aliens arrive and attack everybody and start destroying the city of Moscow. And only our smart young Americans seem to have any kind of a clue about how to fight back in this particular situation. So,
obviously.
So there's some quite interesting shots of Moscow emptied out of people. Mm. You know, there's some angles of Moscow that I hadn't seen before. So on a purely sort of lonely planet kind of perspective, it wasn't uninteresting.
Did you know that Moscow has McDonald's? Because I'm pretty sure I saw like five ads for McDonald's in Moscow.
And
so
Starbucks.
So in case you're an American wanting to go over, there is Starbucks and McDonald's in Moscow. So you'll be okay.
And booze as well.
Mm.
So these aliens, you think for quite a lot of the film that they are... unusual aliens for movies in that they are basically balls of light, balls of energy, who are trying to seek energy in order to replenish themselves and what have you. But in a very disappointing turn of events, it turns out that that's just like their force field. And once they're revealed from inside their force field, they're just boring old tentacled, knobbly aliens, just like all of the others, really. So that was a bit of a disappointment. I think that they could have taken that a little bit further. And they can't see through glass, which is handy.
Yeah, that was so ridiculous.
Oh, look,
I thought maybe they couldn't see it because he was standing by between those two magnetic things, like when you walk out of a shop and it beeps. That would make more sense, kind of, because it was like there was a magnetic field
something would have to make sense. I think it was to do with what conducts electricity and what doesn't. And so, but anyway. What lessons did we learn? We learned that Swedes are cowards, Australians are annoying.
Women are useless.
Oh, women perpetually need to be rescued, don't they? God, blimey. And Russians are brave but short-sighted, really, and don't really have perspective on the big picture. But they'll fight like demons. And the other thing that I thought was, you know, was clutching at straws for things that are interesting about this. One is that it stars Emil Hirsch, who I have a lot of time for. Into the Wild, amazing film. Brilliant performance by him. He seems to have disappeared since, and now he's back as a sort of action hero. He looks like River Phoenix, doesn't he?
Hmm.
I suppose that's something. The only other interesting thing is that the big sort of climactic battle takes place on a trolley bus.
Yes.
Which for Wellingtonians, that's, you know, that's like a woohoo, trolley buses.
Yeah, so
there's not many of those around the world.
Yeah, so it was like Speed, Social Network, Aliens. Something else.
Yeah, but without any sort of...
Without any good story. And no. See, the thing that really... I mean, it was... This movie is ridiculous. Like, I'm sorry. This movie is stupid and ridiculous. And, I mean, because these aliens are invisible, it's just... the actors aren't really acting off of anything, which makes sense because, you know, it's like, oh, there's an, what the director is like, there's an alien coming. They're like, but you can't see anything.
No, they're acting against a tennis ball on a stick like actors do all the time nowadays. And, I think the good actors can cope with that, right?
Yeah.
But here we've got four actors who really don't quite have the chops, unfortunately. Emil Hirsch, I'm very disappointed. Hopefully he'll bounce back.
Emil, I'm very disappointed in you.
Yes. Yes. Go back to working with Sean Penn. He knows how to get the best out of you.
Yes. And I thought, you know, their force fields, when you could see them, this kind of orange swirling thing, very interesting, very good particle work. The aliens, they ran out of the budget.
Dumbass.
The aliens looked like something you'd pull out of a Cracker Jack box. Mm. They were garbage.
Very poor. Garbage. Two words for The Darkest Hour.
Pure garbage.
Right. Scientifically incoherent. Is my two words for The Darkest Hour. If you find that you're being dragged to The Darkest Hour as part of, a flat outing or something, maybe you should make your excuses or just sneak into the cinema next door.
Maybe just have a few drinks and everything will get really funny.
That's right. This is, I think, a really good example of a film where yelling at the screen is a perfectly acceptable response to it, particularly because it takes that, it's got that sort of horror structure in that all the characters are sort of picked off one by one. So there is an element of suspense in there, you know, which of the annoying characters is going to go first.
During the film I did wish I was at the Alamo Draft House. They'd be like, oh no, you didn't, no oh no. I could listen to that. But speaking of cinema tact, to cinema manners, I just have a little sub note to add today. So when I went to see The Darkest Hour last night, there's only one other person in the cinema, and I was like, this is great. Like, sometimes if I have to go to these screenings, I prefer to be by myself. Don't have to have other people talking. The one guy who was in the cinema with me was the guy who answered his phone during the movie. Even if there's one other person with you in the cinema, please respect them.
Yeah.
Also, people in Hugo, I don't need to know that you know what's happening. You don't need to lean over and whisper really loudly, he's going to be behind the door. Like, just be quiet. Keep those thoughts on the inside.
Yeah. I think there's one situation where I'll allow that, and that's when they've got young kids or kids who are really young who perhaps do need a little bit of guiding through the story or a little bit of sort of bringing back to the film. I'm a little bit more forgiving of that. But actually, the worst culprits are in fact the oldies, aren't they, on a Sunday morning? Sunday morning screenings with the oldies. They talk through it like they're watching television at home. And boy, that's a wee bit of a trial. That is the last review.
Yeah, cinema manners for the week.
Cinematica episode 14 coming to an end. Next week on the show, we feature the return of Kiwi favourites The Naked Salmons and Sione's Wedding 2, Unfinished Business. We were hoping to review it this week, but we didn't get an invitation to the world premiere. Just a note for industry people who might be listening to the podcast, we didn't get an invitation to the world premiere, noted. Another sequel, this time Jules Verne gets an update, Journey to the Mysterious Island. That's another 3D film featuring The Rock and Michael Caine. And we finally get to talk about next week a film we saw before Christmas, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
And we also finally get to talk about Restless, which will be coming to Wellington.
And yes, they're sending us a version of it that we can watch.
Yes.
So we will be talking about Restless next week. Finally. Yes, indeed. All right. We're going to leave you for a little bit with some music from Buck. This is Pearl Jam and Just Breathe, which is featured heavily in the film. It's a lovely, lovely song.
I understand that every life must end, as we sit alone, I know someday we must go, I'm a lucky man to count on both hands the ones I love. Some folks just have one, others, they got none. Stay with me, let's just breathe.
Pearl Pearl Jam and Just Breathe from the soundtrack of the film Buck, which was one of our top films in this week's edition of the Cinematica podcast. That's the end of episode 14. Thank you very much for listening, everybody, and we'll be downloaded into your iTunes or up on the website this time next week. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or whatever your favorite podcasting software is. That way the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. You don't have to remember. Please leave us some feedback at the iTunes store. Ratings, reviews are all super useful, so more and more people can help discover the show. You can also contact us via Twitter
at CinematicaCast.
And we've got our own website, cinematica.co.nz. What's our Facebook location?
It is facebook.com/cinematicapodcast.
Fantastic. So lots of ways to get in touch with us. The show is executive produced by Simon Wherry, produced, engineered and edited by me, Dan Slevin. The news editor and weather girl is Kaylee Carruthers. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. And there's the lovely Pearl Jam, Just Breathe. That's it from me, Dan Slevin.
And from me, Kaylee Carruthers.
Thank you very much, Miriam, for being with us in the studio.
Thank you.
And we'll catch you all next time round. Oh, did I say that I want you? Oh, if I didn't, I'm a fool, you see. No one knows this more than me. And I come cleaner. Till I eat you on the other side.